This is Eco Radio KC, a locally produced exploration of positive solutions to the ecological challenges we face as we work to create a healthier future for our community and the planet.
Good evening, and thank you for tuning in to Eco Radio. On tonight's program, we'll hear from Victoria Cherry from Nourish KC and Mariah Friend from After the Harvest KC as they join Craig Lebeau to talk about food waste, including free area screenings of the movie Wasted. Additionally, Kim Noble and Kareen Taylor from Dream Corp USA, a Green for All affiliate, join Richard Mabium. But first, I'm As I Evolve with your headline news. EcoWatch.com reports, in a blow to Monsanto, Arkansas has bans on controversial herbicide to remain. Monsanto lost its bid to overturn Arkansas's ban on dicamba, a controversial weed killer linked to extensive damage to farmers' crops in the state as well as several other states. The agribusiness giant makes a version of the herbicide called Extendimax that's paired with its seeds that are genetically engineered to resist the product. Pulaski County Circuit Judge Chris Piazza dismissed Monsanto's lawsuit Friday, citing in a recent Arkansas Supreme Court ruling, which held that the state cannot be made a defendant in court. Monsanto, which expects farmers to plant 40 million acres of dicamba-tolerant soybeans and 6 million acres of a cotton version across the United States this year, sued the Arkansas State Plant Board over its decision to ban the herbicide's sale and use between October 31st. The regulators made the decision after receiving nearly 1,000 complaints last year over dicamba damage. The powerful and drift-prone herbicide has been blamed for damaging more than 3 million acres of non-target crops across the country. Other states such as Tennessee and Missouri, Monsanto's home state, have also imposed temporary bans or restrictions on the use of dicamba to curb further damage. Also from EcoWatch, conservationists have found a nest of a critically endangered turtle with 16 eggs along Cambodia's Kokong province, the Wildlife Conservation Society announced Monday. Known locally as the royal turtle, the reptile got its name because it was historically considered a delicacy reserved for the Cambodian royal family. It was designated as the country's national reptile in 2005. The turtles were believed to be extinct until its rediscovery in the river in 2000. Only three nests were found in the last 2 years. The Southern River Terrapin is currently listed on IUCN's Red List as critically endangered. This is the first nest of the Southern River Terrapin discovered this year. Four local community rangers have been hired to guard the nest until the eggs hatch. The Irish Times reports that plastic pollution is affecting marine life in some of the most remote parts of the Atlantic Ocean, with almost three-quarters of a sample of more than 230 deep-water fish collected by the National University of Galway. Scientists have found that have ingested plastic particles. Microplastics are small plastic fragments that commonly originate from the breakdown of large plastic items entering the ocean. Other sources may be wastewater effluents, carrying plastic fibers from clothing, and microbeads from personal care products. Due to their low density, most of these microplastics float at the sea surface. Many of these ingested microplastics have associated additives, such as colorants and flame retardants that are added to plastics during the production process, and/or pollutants that are absorbed on the microplastics from the sea. There is evidence now that some of these toxins on the microplastics can be transferred to animals that eat them with potentially harmful effects, says co-author Dr. Tom Doyle at the Ryan Institute at NUIG. Lastly, the Bay Journal reports that twice in the last 4 years, Pennsylvania Supreme Court has rendered decisions putting teeth in the Environmental Rights Amendment, first in a lawsuit over whether communities have the power to bar hydraulic fracturing, and later over how the legislature is spending revenue derived from leasing forest land for fracking, as a controversial natural gas extraction method is known. The High Court's ruling in 2013 and 2017 have generated buzz among lawyers and elected officials, as well as heartened environmental activists used to losing political scraps with the state's powerful extractive industries. The full import of the court's decision has yet to play out, with more litigation in the works. But already, some activists have been emboldened to push to expand its application in Pennsylvania and to spread similar green amendments nationwide. And here's Craig.
Okay, thank you, Rachel. This is Craig Lubo, and today I have Mariah Friend from After the Harvest, and Victoria Cherry from Nourish KC. We're going to be talking about, first we'll be talking about film Wasted, which is about food waste in our country, and they're going to tell you about that film, and then we'll also talk about some of the specific activities and things that each organization does. Welcome.
Thank you. Thanks for having us.
Okay. So your two organizations are co-sponsoring the film Wasted. What is that movie about?
So really it's a documentary about the different ways that food across the globe is wasted, and then also it provides innovative solutions for how we can tackle that issue of food waste. So, 40% of food that is produced is wasted. That number is higher if you just look at fruits and vegetables, and it goes up to 52%. So that's over half of what is produced that goes to waste. So really the film just kind of talks with a variety of different, chefs that are well-known and just talking about different ways that we can start reducing that food waste.
All right. And Victoria, do you have anything to add?
I think one of the reasons why it was important for us to participate in this series of free screenings was that a lot of us don't even think about where our food goes once we throw it away. Yet it's one of the leading causes of greenhouse gases across our country. And it's literally by wasting so much, we're taking food out of the mouths of people who are hungry.
And there's going to be multiple screenings, so I don't want to list all the screenings because they won't remember, but the first one starts what day?
Actually, the first one is our kickoff event tomorrow. We're partnering with agencies across the community, so there are a variety of screenings, whether you're here in the Midtown or if you're in Lawrence, Bonner Springs. We've got one in North Kansas City as well. Tomorrow, the event is at the Linwood YMCA, 5 p.m. We've got a great list of panelists lined up, and so we're really excited to kick it off tomorrow.
All right. How many total screenings?
We have seven planned in about a month's time, so
okay.
Quite a few.
So if people want to see one of the screenings, what website would they go to see the dates and locations?
So we have all of the events on our website. It's aftertheharvestkc.org, and then from there you can look at our events page and you can register. Again, all of the screenings are free, so we're really just wanting to provide a community conversation for people to come together and learn more about what's going on in Kansas City. But some of the venues are a little bit smaller, so we're just asking people to register.
All right. And Victoria, is it listed on your website too?
Actually, we have a series of Facebook event pages, so you can log on and learn more about the various panelists that we have at our screenings. We've split up the moderations because there are seven. So we will be doing the one at the Kansas City Public Library on February 28th. And then on March 19th, in addition to tomorrow's March 19th at the Kansas City, Kansas Public Library.
All right. And so there'll be a panel talking about the film after the film. Will this be people from your two organizations and other local organizations, or will the film producer or director be there too?
We would love if that were the case. Actually, we have tried to be intentional about the panelists having someone who represents, from the restaurant perspective, someone who is there as a farmer. After the Harvest, we'll be on the panel kind of talking about gleaning and what we do as far as food waste goes. And Nourish KC will also be moderating and on the panel. So,
all right. And can you tell us what the term gleaning means?
Yeah, so gleaning actually comes from, it's kind of a historical term. It was used in the Bible, and it just means to take what's left over in the fields or what's excess and then give it to the hungry. So current day terms, we just use that to mean that any produce that is left over in the fields, we organize volunteers. We go out to different orchards, farms, community gardens, and we spend a few hours to harvest that food, and then we donate it locally here to organizations.
And does Nourish KC do the same type of thing too?
So where our work intersects is After the Harvest does the gleaning, and our organization Our work is centered on building a food secure region through innovative programs and collaborations throughout the food system network of Kansas City. One of our biggest programs is the Kansas City Community Kitchen, which is on the Paseo, 750 Paseo. We serve about 100,000 meals to people every day of the week, and 90% of that food that we provide to our guests comes from donated product. I think last year, correct me if I'm wrong, we got about 5,000 pounds of produce from after the harvest.
Yeah, I think, you know, that's something that we do. We deliver directly to agencies like, you know, the Kansas City Community Kitchen. We also are the number one donor of produce to Harvesters, the Community Food Network. So gleaning is just one of the ways that we provide produce to those agencies. We have another program as well that brings in even more produce.
It sounds like then all of what your two organizations does is focus on produce. Are there also organizations similar to yours that help in terms of getting donated meats and other and grains for people?
Yep, we have a handful of community partners who provide those kind of products to us. Several restaurants, Whole Foods is a huge community partner of ours as well.
Okay. And you talk about gleaning and getting the food that from the field, the leftover food. What about if food is to the point where it's rotting, is that composted or used in some way?
A lot of different organizations do, you know, directly use the compost, but, you know, ours, we mostly focus on the second. So, you know, the produce that necessarily wouldn't be marketable, but it's still completely nutritious, it's edible, it's fresh, that's kind of our focus. But a lot of the panelists that we're bringing in about, you know, the wasted screening, they are going to kind of address that issue as well, talking about different ways to compost, whether you're a large-scale farmer or you're, you know, just in your home, in your kitchen, different ways that they can reduce that food waste if it's not edible, if it's to the point where it can't go to feed hungry people.
And from your website, you have a lot of information, statistics about hunger in Kansas and Missouri. And in Missouri, it indicates 17.1% are, I'm not sure if that's food deprived or if that means they're going to bed hungry or what.
It most likely speaks to food insecurity, which is okay. The feeling of not knowing where your next meal will come from.
All right. And on the Kansas side, that figure is 14.7%. So how do they obtain those figures? Is it based upon people who apply for food stamps or something else?
I think a lot of our numbers come from, you know, Harvesters, where we donate the majority of our produce is part of the Feeding America network, and so they do a lot of independent studies to provide kind of those numbers. We usually use the ones that they have since we aren't able as a small organization to kind of get those statistics ourselves. But, you know, in Kansas City, about 141,000 people seek emergency food assistance each month. So, and that comes directly from Harvester's website. So that's quite a few people when you think about it.
All right. What are some of the ramifications or side effects of food insecurity?
So what we've found with the many people that we help through our organization, a lot of people who are hungry or food insecure can't think right. I ask people to put yourself in these people's shoes. Imagine a day where you woke up, you were in a rush, you had an 8 a.m. meeting, and you didn't have breakfast. And then you had a meeting after that, and then a lunch meeting. So you didn't eat all day. Like, how did that make you feel during that day? You were probably feeling pretty slow, pretty tired, pretty groggy. And then I ask you to think about what that's like to live like that every single day, to not know where that your next meal comes from. What we believe in our organization is by offering that first hot, nutritious meal, and it's very critical to us that our meals are very healthy and well-balanced nutritionally, but by offering that first meal, we're filling people's bellies, and also we're nourishing their souls as well. But by virtue of doing that, then in a continuum of care, we're enabling them to then think better for themselves, to be able to graduate from, you know, the barriers of poverty into shopping food pantries, learning how to cook their own meals, and eventually learning how to shop for groceries themselves.
What about, do you teach them how to garden and grow food of their own?
Well, actually, we have many partner organizations that do specifically that kind of work. But one of the programs that we offer through Nourish KC is the Culinary Cornerstones Training Program, where many people who are chronically underemployed, they might suffer from mental health challenges or homelessness. We give them the opportunity to train at the community kitchen. It's a 30-week, 800-hour program, and it's basically, you know, you start with basic kitchen skills, and you can graduate on through internships and ultimately full-time employment.
And I think I saw on your bio that you kind of specialize somewhat in the connection of nutrition to health.
Absolutely.
So the people you're working with that need your help, what do you see as the more common health issues that they have?
So my background is actually in nursing. I was a critical care nurse for about 4 years. And what I saw working in that environment was that so many people that were coming, you know, to the hospital as patients and returning for more than one visit had a lot of chronic health issues that were definitely preventable. And a lot of those would be prevented by, you know, just eating healthy food, having access to healthy food, having awareness about what a nutritional lifestyle looks like, the different kind of nutrients that you need to maintain health. And this is something that, for me, is important because it can prevent those chronic diseases that, you know, are really debilitating for people. Another thing that I think about when I think about, you know, people that are seeking emergency food assistance, a lot of times at home they're trying to make this decision, this very difficult decision between paying for their medication and getting healthy food for their families. So from a community standpoint, it's really important to me that, you know, they don't have to make those tough decisions and that they can not only provide for their families that healthy food, but then also prevent the disease process.
And in gathering the food and gleaning the food and all, is this primarily from farms that would be organic? And obviously it would be local, but is it mostly organic produce?
So we work with all types of farmers. You know, I think that from my perspective, I think organic is ideal. But, you know, if anyone is willing to donate excess produce to us, you know, we definitely don't want to turn them away. So we work with large-scale farmers. We work with community gardens. We work with growers who maybe say, hey, I have two apple trees in my backyard, and all of the apples fall off the tree, and my family only uses, you know, a small percentage. So we're open to really working with any type.
What
did I was going to say, getting back to the health perspective of our organization, a high percentage of our guests suffer from heart conditions. They have diabetes. They suffer from obesity. And this is where it becomes very important that we talk about how food rescue is critical, but it's not the end-all be-all to end food insecurity. What's important to us is that we're getting produce and products donated to us that are that allow us to make those healthy, nutritious meals every day at our kitchen. A lot of times, you know, boxed products and sweets and those kind of things, those aren't the kind of things that we would really serve to our guests because we don't want to promote those chronic illnesses that they're suffering from.
One of the things on your site, and this is the after the harvest site, is that the figures for insecurity and hunger have not really changed, and they're about the same as they were in 2008 at the beginning of the recession when unemployment was rising and all that. Why do you think that is? Is it not tied that much to economics, or
You know, I think it's definitely a complex issue, and there are different ways to address it. You know, I think some of it is that the data hasn't been updated. So one of the things that we're focusing on this year is our organization is going to be doing an outcome study. So we are going to be going out to the food agencies that we provide nutritional produce to, and we're going to be taking those surveys and asking those questions to our direct clients. Is this improving your quality of life? How much produce are you receiving through this agency? So we're really hoping that that is going to reflect what we really believe to be true, and that, you know, this is important work that we're doing. You know, I think talking about the emergency food system is, you know, a whole nother topic as far as, you know, why people need to seek emergency food assistance. But, you know, our primary focus is really on, for those that do find themselves in that position, being able to provide them not just with the cereal and the bread and everything like that, but really food that is going to, you know, serve their bodies and maybe help them kind of overcome some of those obstacles.
One of the things on the site says relating to the health, and as a critical healthcare nurse before, like your input on this, it says 52%, those who are food insecure, 52% more likely to have asthma, as well as 53% more likely to have a heart attack. So some of that, like you mentioned, Victoria, diabetes and some of mm-hmm. that. And I think that's easy to understand the connection between food and diabetes. Mm-hmm. What's the connection between the food and asthma?
You know, I think it's all interrelated. I mean, anytime you try to take one body system and separate it from the other, you know, you're not really doing yourself justice. You know, our organisms are very complex, and I think part of what I believe that healthy food can do for people is, you know, reduce the amount of toxins that are going into your body. You're talking about preservatives. You're talking about, you know, things that are maybe GMO. You know, asthma is something that, you know, your body is triggering an inflammatory process. And so, you know, you're also looking at people with all these different food allergies. That's also an inflammatory process. And so I think that, you know, it's definitely all connected. And I think we're just now, after, you know, decades of serving or, you know, purchasing or producing food that isn't healthy for us, we're just now starting to look at the implications long term.
I think from an asthma perspective as well, asthma can be induced by heat, by extreme cold. It can be induced by, you know, getting your heart rate up very quickly. But I don't want us to minimize the stress that a lot of these people that we serve also feels. And that, I think, that plays into our health and wellness as well.
And what are some of the other activities that each of your organization does anything we haven't talked about?
Yeah, so one of the other programs that we do after the harvest is we have a large truckload program. So that is where the majority of our produce that we donate to harvesters actually comes from. Last year, we were able to donate over 5 million pounds of produce to harvesters and other agencies. And so basically what we do is we work with a broker who kind of lets us know, okay, there's, you know, a truckload of 40,000 pounds of potatoes, or maybe it's pineapple or cabbage that for whatever reason it's, you know, docked at Walmart and it's been rejected. Well, there's nothing really wrong with that produce, but it's just, you know, an instance of they don't want to accept it. So we pay for the shipping and packaging, and then harvesters receives that produce. So that's a large part of what our organization does. It's kind of behind the scenes. And then our gleaning program is really where the volunteers get involved, where it's more local and community focused.
Why do places, I mean, I guess you'd be speculating, but places like Walmart or other grocery stores, why do they reject produce if it's edible, instead of accepting it and maybe putting it on sale for the price the poor people could afford?
You know, I think it has a lot to do with supply and demand and what the consumer expectation is as far as, you know, if it's a little bit bruised or if it's smaller than what you are normally looking for in a you know, tomato or whatever. There are a variety of reasons, but a lot of it is, you know, we're not really used to being able to see that connection from farm to fork of where our food comes from. We have this expectation that all tomatoes are this shape, they're this color, and if a store is trying to sell that, you know, I think until we kind of bring a different awareness to what food really looks like, what it can look like, you know, it's going to go to waste in the store, and so the store is not going to accept produce that isn't, you know, exactly fitting that kind of model.
And so, pardon me, one of the things that makes me think of is all of the produce that comes to us, or 90% of the produce that comes to our community kitchen is donated product. And it might not be the prettiest, it might be a day over expiration, or it might be expiring in a week. But I would invite folks to come down to the Kansas City Community Kitchen and eat our lunches, and want. They would have no idea where that food came from, whether it was, you know, the ugliest parsley on the shelf or the prettiest, most expensive that a grocery store would sell. And that's one of the beauties when we talk about our individual different programs. That's one of the beauties about our community kitchen. It's a dining with dignity model. Last year, we had more than 6,000 volunteers from across Kansas City who come in and do shifts during the lunch hour. So that we don't operate like a soup kitchen. We're a restaurant. People get to come in, they get seated, they get waited on. We couldn't do that work and give that dignity back to people without those volunteers. Behind the scenes, it's equally interesting and awesome to watch our kitchen staff take in these donations with very limited amount of space and freezer space, and to basically look at it and say, okay, we can make this beautiful, healthy meal out of this tomorrow with a gluten-free, a vegetarian option every day. We can save this for Wednesday, and we can make meatballs out of it. So it's a pretty fascinating process, and it's very wonderful to see it all kind of come together from the donations through organizations like After the Harvest and other community partners as well as volunteers.
Is your work limited mostly to the Missouri side, or do you do both Missouri and Kansas?
So we glean, we have a pretty wide radius. We say that all of our gleanings are from about 30 to 45 minutes from Kansas City. We do work with other food banks that are larger. Just Food is one in Lawrence that we work with and donate to. So it's on both sides of the state line, but kind of within that, I would say, hour radius maximum of Kansas City.
And you mentioned Just Food. Is that like what Harvesters does? Is that same time?
It is a food bank, so that means that they will distribute food from their warehouse to other smaller pantries or agencies. It's not the same size as Harvesters, but it's kind of the same concept.
All right. And we just have a couple minutes left. Let me, first of all, Mariah, after the harvest, if you'll give the website again so people can get information about general information as well as the movie.
Sure. So our website is www.afterTheHarvestKC.org. You can go to our events page and look at all of our screenings of Wasted, the story of food waste. We have about 7 coming up in the next few weeks.
All right. And Victoria, your website and the Facebook page.
Yep, our website is nourishkc.org. And exciting news, we're in the middle of a rebrand, so look for our new website coming within the next few months. But in the meantime, check us out on Facebook to find out more about the screenings and also just get some background on the different panelists that we have coming up.
All right. And for the Facebook page, if they just do a search for Nourish KC, they'll find you.
Yep, Nourish KC.
All right, so I want to thank both of you for being here.
It was a pleasure. Thank you for having us.
Thank you so much.
Coming up next, we'll have a break, and then Richard Mabian will come in here with his two guests talking about the listening session.
Hey, John Todd. KKFI invites you to join us on the air or in person at our 30th anniversary open house.
Yes, Maria. It's Saturday, February 24th, 9 a.m. to 6 p.m. right here in the KKFI studios.
There's live music, food, and history tours of KKFI.
And if you can't join us in person, you can call in and share your KKFI story with us. at 816-931-5534, or that's 816-931-KKFI.
Right here at the KKFI studios at 3901 Main Street, Kansas City, Missouri. Thanks for listening, and please come celebrate with us Saturday, February 24th, 9 a.m. to 6 p.m.
I'll see you there.
You bet.
Stand Up KC and the Heartland Center for Jobs and Freedom are hosting Lives on the Line, a night of unforgettable stories from low-wage workers. The Story Slam event takes place on Saturday, February 24th at 7 p.m. at St. Paul's Episcopal Church at 40th and Main. Tickets and info available by looking up Lives on the Line on Eventbrite. This message, a public service of 90.1 FM KKFI, Kansas City Community Radio.
I'm Dr. Anthony Lizowitz, and this is Climate Connections. Rising carbon dioxide levels are causing climate change, but they could also be making the food on your plate less nutritious.
Every time you eat, say, a carrot or a bread or potatoes, the quality of it is different than all else being equal it was, say, 100 years ago.
Irakli Laladze of Nebraska's Bryan College of Health Sciences studies how carbon dioxide levels affect plant nutrients. He analyzed studies from around the world that examine the nutrient levels of plants grown in experiments with elevated levels of CO2. The data include more than 7,000 samples of 130 plant varieties, including rice, wheat, and other grains, as well as fruits and vegetables. Laladze says the overall trend is clear.
Rising CO2 lowers the concentrations of minerals. So calcium, magnesium, zinc, iron, they all drop.
The effects are small, and the cumulative effects on human health are still unknown. But because mineral deficiencies can cause medical and developmental problems, he says it's a worrisome finding, especially for people already struggling to meet their basic nutritional needs. Climate Connections is produced by the Yale Center for Environmental Communication. Learn more at yaleclimateconnections.org.
All right, this is Richard Mabian. You had a change in your host. Hello, everybody. Glad to be here. We have a special event going on this week, the 21st, and I have a couple of young ladies here who just flew into our gorgeous city today, and so we wanted to make sure we got a chance to get them here on air so that we could talk to you all about this listening session that's going on with EPA. You know, we've been talking about it. We had the Missouri Sierra Club on here last week, or week before last, I think it's last week. And we had some folks from the Kansas Sierra Club come on talking about the session and getting people to sign up and stuff. Well, this group is like family for me. This goes back to my days of Green for All when I was out there with Van Jones when before he got picked to go up and work with Obama. I was in the last class he had before he went there. So the second class of his academy, being a fellow, and the last class he had before he went to D.C. So a lot of my trips that I had going to D.C. was because of my affiliation with the Green for All. So I'm really excited to be sitting here with them. I'm going to let the young ladies introduce themselves and just kind of give you a quick blurb of what it is they're about and what they're here for now. First, let's talk about who you're with, the Dream Corps thing. So sure. Either one of you, go ahead.
Yeah, okay. So we're thrilled to be with you too, Richard. This is really an honor for us to get a chance to come around and talk to one of Green for All's fellows and a Green for All fellow who's doing so well, you know, and still carrying that vision. So our vision is to build an inclusive green economy strong enough to lift people out of poverty. You know, Van Jones founded Green for All 10 years ago. So this year we celebrate our 10th year anniversary. And he had the vision back then that you can and should fight poverty and pollution at the same time.
Right.
And that was unheard of back then. And he was right on it. We can match our economic vision with our environmental vision. We can do both. And so that's what Green for All is about. I'm the director of national partnerships. I'm based in D.C. and been with Green for All now for about 6 years.
National partnership, is that a separate entity over Dream Corps, or is that a part of Dream Corps?
So Green for All is an initiative of the Dream Corps. It's okay. also founded by Van Jones. He's our president and founder,
okay. right.
not only of Green for All, but also the Dream Corps. So we have Green for All. That's our environmental vision. That's, okay. you know, addressing those issues that I just talked about, poverty right. and pollution.
Right.
So then we also have an initiative called the Cut 50,
okay.
which is criminal justice reform.
That was originally his the group that he formed had to do with mm-hmm. the prison systems and
yes.
stuff. Van was very much instrumental in getting involved with that.
Absolutely.
All right, young lady, your turn.
Well, good evening, everyone. My name's Corrine Taylor. I'm the policy director for Green for All, and I've been with Green for All almost a year now. It's like, wow, how fast did that go? But I come from an environmental justice background. I've worked with a number of organizations, one being We Act for Environmental Justice in Harlem, and that kind of experience really helped me kind of sink my teeth into environmental justice work, just advocating for communities and making sure that, especially in Washington, D.C., that our initiatives and our goals aren't taken for granted at the federal level. So here at Green for All, I still continue to do that work, but of course with an emphasis on economic development and making sure, like Kim had said, that our mission is pushed through in whatever initiative that we're doing, looking at how Congress and the EPA is interacting with communities, but also making sure that there are initiatives in place to also allow us to benefit from those things through economic development.
You know, you just don't know, sitting here, I'm getting all these vibes and feelings about the connection that we actually have with each other. Very much so, coming from the two different perspectives, me being local, me being out here, boots on the ground kind of a person, and then you all being where you are with the policy concerns that you have and the political issues and concerns that you have, which is really kind of what brought you here now. And that's very important. Tell us, what you got going on?
Well, sure. The EPA is hosting a listening session on Wednesday around the Clean Power Plan and the what looks like an attempt to repeal what we believe is a very important rule to address carbon pollution from our power plants. And we just wanted to, well, before we even came, there was a very big concern that just administratively, folks weren't being able to really voice how they felt about the Clean Power Plan. There were millions of people who submitted comments in favor of it. We thought that this would be a really great way to get us to be in compliance with our Paris Accord agreements and things of that nature. But of course, when administrations change, focuses change. And whereas we were trying to kind of push toward more green and clean economy options, there seems to be kind of a decision to go kind of backwards policy-wise and focus-wise. And so with the Clean Power Plan, these listening sessions, we just felt that this would be a great opportunity to provide communities an opportunity to say how they feel about the rule, why this rule could be important, but even beyond why the rule is important, what communities are already doing to address carbon pollution, what communities are already doing to look at how to employ people of color, to have equity be a part of the discussion. And so with us coming here this week, in addition to our own testimony, we wanted to work with local voices like yourself here in the Kansas City area to talk about what this plan could mean for Kansas City and what's already happening on the ground.
Okay, you know, we had a pretty active, I go back to the ones out there listening, understand, we were directly, at least I was directly involved with the Clean Power Plan effort back before they abandoned it and cut it off. And I was working with a group here called Climate Energy Project, and they had set up an agreement with the NAACP. Because, see, I'm always concerned on the ground of getting the word into the homes of our people of color. And so we were going to work out a fundraiser with them where our elderly members would come in and create a phone bank. And so they would get on the phone and call people's homes telling them about the Clean Power Plan. That's what our issue is mm-hmm. to make sure people know exactly what it is you're talking about that's going on now. And so I had my involvement in that. And they were really excited about doing it. About the time we were ready to kick it off, that's when the plan went belly up on us. Kim, what are you expecting to occur? Tell us about the date. where the location? Have you got that down? Are you, I know you just got in town. Do you know? Do you have where places are and what you're going to be dealing with?
Yeah. Well, we're super excited. So it's going to be in conjunction, really, with the hearing. So we made sure that we set up our community conversation. That's what we're calling it. And it's going to be on Wednesday, the 21st. Breakfast will be served at 8:30, and then the program kicks off at 9. And it will be at the Mid-America Regional Council building, also known as MARC.
Yep. Right. 600 Broadway there. Okay.
600
Kansas
Broadway.
City.
Yeah. And as Kareen said, we just wanted to have a conversation with folks, really to talk about what's already happening on the ground here in Kansas City and what the Clean Power Plan means for this change. And if the Clean Power Plan is moving away, what changes still will be going forward? And so y'all are already doing some terrific things. I love that phone bank idea of getting folks to call.
Yes.
I think people need to still do that.
Right,
But there are things that we're already doing. We're seeing clean energy move forward. We're seeing communities changing. We're seeing pollution being addressed in our communities. We know that low-income communities and communities of color are hit hardest by climate change and pollution. So the Clean Power Plan was a way to address both of those issues. And so we're like, okay, if this goes away, you know, like Kareen said, when different administrations come, different focuses come.
We've got to have that.
And we also have to be realistic. We're going to fight tooth and nail for the Clean Power Plan. But if it moves on, that doesn't mean the fight is over.
Right.
That just means we need to go a different way.
Well, and I think the joining forces that we're doing right now, and I'm talking between you two and myself and the other boots on the ground folks that I know, to be able to get that word, because that's where it's at. Administrations come and go, but peoples remain. Mm-hmm. So we need to make sure people understand. I have a problem with recycling. You know, when you move into our low-income communities, a recycle truck can go for miles and there's no buckets out. So we need to be in a position, that would be something great while we own them phone banks and we're talking about blah-da-da-da-da, that we throw a little something in there about why we need to recycle. It's not just something that the city came up for you to do so they can make extra money. Mm-hmm. There's some long-range things here. Even though it's a low-hanging fruit, still it has a visual aspect about it that is not only a benefit to the economy, but it's also a benefit to our future generations. That's who we need to reach, and we can do that. So that way they can be more engaged in who's in office as they grow up because of the knowledge that they have about the environment and also because of their realizing what they're doing and why they should be doing it. So I noticed you have do you have the name of the folks who's going to be on the panel? You got a panel going to be there. Do you have them?
That's a really
do
good
you
panel.
Have them? Because if you don't, I'll dig it off my eyes.
So we're really honored and excited about the panelists that we have. Just to name them, we have Gloria Ortiz Fisher, the Executive Director of Westside Housing Network, Clyde McQueen, President and CEO of Full Employment Council, Dennis Murphy, the Chief Environmental Officer for the Kansas City, Missouri, Ashok Gupta, the Senior Energy Economist for NRDC, and Margaret May, the Executive Director of Ivanhoe Neighborhood Council. And we know Margaret is retired, so we're really appreciative of her coming out, you know. Yeah, and she's been a stalwart of this community, someone who's been an environmental justice advocate for years. So.
Margaret and I are the two environmental justice folks. We both, in fact, last year we got the Region 7 Environmental Justice Man and Female for the Year Award at the same time they had us out to give it to us. And we got started into this together back in 2008, and she's been a stalwart person from the community perspective. I like community centers. She has built out from there in her neighborhood and has done an outstanding job and has set what I would consider a roadmap for other folks who are trying to do something in the neighborhoods to do. I don't work in the neighborhood. I work for the neighborhoods, and she works in the neighborhoods. Mm-hmm. And so people need to know her, too. So I'm looking forward to her being there. It's kind of like we see each other. It's like a reunion for us.
I want to add one more name.
Oh, yes.
Congressman Cleaver is going to be there.
Oh, is he?
Cleaver, yes.
Okay.
He will be providing opening remarks.
Oh, okay.
As part
very
of that conversation,
good.
We're super thrilled to have
yeah.
him.
Oh, yeah.
And his office was just excellent and very helpful with us just planning this. You know, we live and work in Washington, D.C., right, in the DMV right. area, so we want to make sure that when we come into any city, we did our work. We reached out to you. Yeah. We reached out to NAACP here. We reached out to his office, the mayor's office, et cetera, because when we get on our plane on Thursday, you're left to continue on right. and, you know, move things forward.
Right.
So, you know, we're happy to have had all of your support.
Well, like I said, I'm glad that we was in a position to do this. And it just, when you sent the email, it just made all the sense in the world mm-hmm. that we needed to get you in here. So let's go through this again. The times that you're going to be.
So for sure, our community conversation will be Wednesday, the 21st at 8:30. We'll be offering breakfast because we know it's the morning and we value your time. And then from about 9 to 10 will be the panel discussion. It may go a little bit longer. And we also understand that some folks may have already signed up for their time slot for the EPA listening
yeah,
session. So if you have to leave, we understand.
Yeah.
And that's that period for the EPA listening session is from 10 a.m. on the 21st till 8 p.m. that night. So
right.
this is just, you know, an early morning conversation with stakeholders. We hope that we have a diverse group of people there. Of
well,
diverse interests.
Yeah, and I saw plenty of emails
Good.
Going by. Mostly, though, were concerned about they tied up at that time.
Yeah,
and they're
yeah.
not going to be able to get there, which is why I made sure that I would make sure that I was there to represent the environmental movement from the Kansas perspective, mm-hmm. like Kansas Sierra Club. Mm-hmm. It'll be in the house. It'll mm-hmm. be there. The Kansas NAACP will be in Kansas City. Kansas NAACP will be in the house because I'll be in the house.
Mm-hmm.
And as long as we're there, that allows us to be able to represent and let people know that we're represented.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's good for you to be able to bring these people you got to the table to be on the panels, and that's one thing I want them to understand is that we also have a large group of folks across the water that are equally and actively engaged, maybe not as black as you'll find maybe in Kansas City, Missouri, but multiculturally we are really refining things over
mm-hmm.
there. So it's good. So breakfast, you're going to have anything for meat and line meat eaters?
It'll be a real vegan kind of
yeah.
We're
yeah.
trying to keep it light.
Yeah.
Light and healthy.
Bagels, yogurt,
well,
fruit.
Okay, so is there anything to deal with energy efficiency in the clean power plan conversation? Do you know?
Well, for sure, in the clean power plan, there was the what is it? What was it called?
The CEIP.
The CEIP,
yeah.
the Clean Energy
incentive program,
and
right.
that was going to be just a way to provide communities and businesses locally with a way to benefit from the plan.
Right, right.
And I know they did a number of hearings around that. The EPA did. I attended one in Chicago, I think almost 2 years ago in Chicago.
Right, right.
And that would have been a really great way to kind of help businesses invest more in solar, help businesses try to find ways to address weatherization. And weatherization might be the most impactful way to address our energy use. You know, if your homes aren't insulated well, if your homes are too old and they haven't been brought up to code, or there's still a number of repairs and leaks going on,
right.
regardless of the solar panel on your roof, you're going to be losing heat, you're going to be losing electricity because your home isn't weatherized. So those kinds of initiatives were definitely a part of the Clean Power Plan. I think communities asked for it and begged for some type of incentive program to encourage their participation. Now, the issue is, without that type of federal structure in place, what are we going to do
right.
to make sure, you know,
well,
moving forward?
That's one of our stalwart programs in Kansas City, Kansas, for the Kansas Sierra Club, especially in the inner city. You know, that's an area that's kind of foreign to a lot of our environmental organizations.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, they work in with the issues that's going on in those areas, but it's real foreign to them as far as educating the people that are there. So we've been setting pilot programs in place, hoping that they'll catch on. And one that we're doing right now is spearheading passing out LED bulbs to the elderly.
Mm-hmm.
Lights in the inner city is almost a necessity.
Mm-hmm.
So when you're burning 75 watts or whatever wattage you're using out there, burning up your energy,
mm-hmm.
It's a whole lot different than turning around and putting in some of those LEDs that are 9 watts. And that's one of the things we're doing, and it's just going over real well. Mm-hmm. So that's why I wanted to make sure that that was still there. All right, it's time for us to kind of give this up. It always goes by fast when you're having a good time. So good. I'll let you say the times one more time. And
sure.
I want to say thank you for being here.
Okay. Well, again, we will be here. Well, we're already here, but on Wednesday the 21st, 8:30 breakfast and 9 a.m. at the Mid-Atlantic Regional Council office, the Mid-American Regional Council office at 600 Broadway. We'll be here with our community conversation.
All right. Thank you.
All right. Now we have our events. A local workshop will highlight college student entries in the U.S. Department of Energy Solar Decathlon House Competition. The Heartland Renewable Energy Society workshop on 2017 Solar Decathlon Highlights will be held from 10 a.m. to noon on Saturday, February 24th at the Shawnee Branch Johnson County Library, 13811 Johnson Drive, Shawnee, Kansas. The annual competition challenges college students to design teams to design and build a full-size solar-powered house. The houses are then taken apart and reconstructed at the competition site. The winning team is chosen for its combination of design excellence, innovative smart energy production, market potential, and energy and water efficiency. Just in time for spring garden cleanup, learn how to make compost from yard and kitchen waste at this free home composting class. Composting at home is the best way to recycle residential organic waste into garden soil. The goal of this class is to provide attendees with enough basic knowledge on composting to begin a project of their own. This class will be held from noon to 1 p.m. on Tuesday, February 27th at the Solid Waste Administrative Building, 320 Northeast Industrial Lane, Lawrence, Kansas. Also, learn about fruit trees, how to care for them, and how they provide food security to communities at this new Orchard Keeper course. Bridging the Gap's Heartland Tree Alliance and the Giving Grove are partnering on a three-day class that delves into tree care and biology, soil and basic fruit biology, site suitability, and other things. The course includes 6 hours of classroom learning and 3 hours of fruit tree pruning from 9 a.m. to noon on February 20th, 21st, and 22nd at the Anita B. Gorman Discovery Center, 4750 Troost. All right, and last, we just want to go ahead and remind you and shout out again about the Empowering Local Voices and Green Entrepreneurs in America's Heartland. That's going to be on February 21st from 8:30 a.m. to 10 a.m. at the Mid-American Regional Council, 600 Broadway, Suite 200, Kansas City, Missouri, after which there will be that EPA listening session you just heard Richard and his guests talk about.
Is there a cure for cancer at the bottom of the Great Lakes? That story and more on H2O Radio's weekly news report. I'm Jamie Sudler.
I'm Franny Halperin, and it's This Week in Water.
While most people in the U.S. have access to safe drinking water, millions in rural areas are exposed to unhealthy and at times even illegal levels of contaminants.
A report published last week in the Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences found that health violations were widespread. Anywhere from about 10 to 45 million people may have been affected each year in the past 3 decades.
The study was done by taking data from the EPA and looking for violations at thousands of water systems. Contaminants included lead, bacteria, nitrates, and arsenic, among others.
Starting in the early 2000s, health violations for drinking water surged in rural areas after the EPA passed rules focused on disinfectants.
Chlorine and other chemicals used to clean water can react with organic matter to create new compounds posing their own health risks. It can be costly and challenging to limit the effects of disinfectants in rural areas.
Parts of Oklahoma and Texas had repeated violations, probably connected to summer temperatures fostering bacteria growth. Mara Allaire of the University of California at Irvine and lead author of the study told the New York Times that rural communities are struggling to maintain aging infrastructure and keep up with the latest water treatment technologies.
And in China, there are some big problems with poor water quality also. Now there are preliminary plans to import supplies from Russia by using trucks or pipelines to the Kamchatka Peninsula.
There, the water would be transferred to tanker ships and be transported on a 10-day journey to various Chinese municipal water systems.
A representative of a Chinese company interested in the large-scale plans said that nowhere else in the world has such a project been done. but a senior researcher at the Russian Academy of Sciences said that the proposal is too expensive and pointless.
According to the Asia Times, Russia is among the world's richest countries in terms of water resources. In contrast, China seriously reduced its freshwater reserves during the 1990s when it rapidly industrialized.
For decades, the Hopi in Arizona have challenged using reclaimed wastewater for snowmaking at a ski area not far from the tribe's reservation. Their efforts until now have been stymied in the courts.
But recently, an Arizona State Appellate Court ruled that the Hopi have the legal right to challenge the Snow Bowl Resort's use of treated effluent to make snow in the areas the tribe considers sacred.
Reclaimed water is treated after it's used in homes and businesses, but not to the level where it's safe to drink. The Native Americans claim that the water sprayed into the air and then falls as snow contains chemicals, pharmaceuticals, illegal drugs, hormones, and personal care products that are left after a limited treatment process.
When the snow melts, it, along with contaminants, gets into streams and lakes. One tribal member told The Guardian that people would never consider using reclaimed water in a Christian baptism ceremony. He also criticized the whole process of making snow, saying it's kind of like shaking your fist at God.
The court ruling now allows the tribe to present their case to a judge or jury.
Scientists studying the bottom of the Great Lakes have found many new species of fungi, and some of them may be able to help fight certain cancers.
Robert Chiovich, a professor of natural products at the University of Oklahoma, led a team of scientists who went to Lakes Michigan, Huron, and Superior and used a giant scoop to collect sediment from lake bottoms.
Before they started, nothing was known about the fungal component of the lakes. The specimens they dug up were shipped to labs where spores were grown on, of all things, Cheerios. The fungi grow well on the breakfast food, according to Chiovich.
Compounds produced by the spores were tested against cancers, and the result was that they killed cells associated with a rare form of the disease that grows on the bones of adolescents known as Ewing sarcoma.
As the Charlevoix Courier reports, use of the chemicals in cancer treatment is still a ways off, but researchers are very excited.
The study found almost 450 new species of fungi not previously known to exist, which is a boon to science in its own right. According to Chiovich, fungi are the most brilliant chemists on Earth, making molecules that humans can use for other purposes.
And finally, as we hear news about drought and water scarcity around the globe, conversations often turn to desalination. But desal has many drawbacks. It's expensive, its wastewater discharges could affect marine life and water quality, and it takes a lot of energy, much of which comes from fossil fuels that are a key contributor to climate change.
But there's a new generation of material on the horizon that could address some of those downsides. They're called MOFs, or metal organic frameworks.
MOF materials can mimic cells, which allow specific atoms or molecules to pass through its membrane while stopping things they don't want. That's known as selective permeability, and now MOF materials can do the same thing and act as a filter to block unwanted compounds like the salt in seawater.
The team of scientists from Australia and the U.S. say the MOF membranes would be far more energy and cost efficient because there's no need for high pressure that current desal systems use to force water through filters.
But wait, there's more. These MOFs could potentially help power your smartphone. That's because seawater contains a lot of lithium, the stuff used in batteries for a slew of electronics. Those lithium ions are left behind after filtering seawater, and they're easily harvested.
And that has an environmental benefit because currently the mining industry uses inefficient chemical treatments to extract lithium from rocks and brines.
Still, we're left with the vexing question of what to do with all that leftover salt. But MOFs are a promising technology for the 2.1 billion people on Earth who don't have access to clean and safe drinking water. This Week in Water is supported by the American Water Works Association, bringing together the best and brightest minds in the water sector at ACE 18. Learn more at awwa.org/ACE18.
Thanks for listening to Eco Radio KC. on 90.1 FM KKFI, Kansas City Community Radio.
You're listening to 90.1 FM KKFI, Kansas City Community Radio.